New citizens, first-time voters, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. I don't have to tell you that a big election is coming up on Tuesday. Today we're going to hear from first-time voters who are eager to cast their ballots.
I just recently became a United States citizen, literally on Halloween, so 2 days ago. And I already had in mind my first order of business was to go and vote.
And this new citizen made the decision to vote back in 2016, 2 years ago on election night. Yeah, that election night.
I remember distinctly that night. I was like, I have to do something. And the first thing I can do was just put in my application for citizenship. And I did that the very next week.
New citizens vote, their stories, and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Next Tuesday, you know what you're supposed to do? Vote. I have a feeling that a lot of you are chomping at the bit to cast your ballots this year. That's what we're hearing.
I just recently became a United States citizen, literally on Halloween, so 2 days ago. And I already had in mind my first order of business was to go and vote here in North Carolina. I really wanted to do my part in this extremely important election.
That's another Marco speaking there. Marco Rosa. We'll hear more from him later. Marco was one of the people who responded to our call out this week, asking new U.S. citizens who are first-time voters this election season for their thoughts, your thoughts. We got some great responses. You can read some of them at theworld.org. Here's another one that came to us from Jo Huang Zollner, who is a first-time voter. She's originally from Taiwan. You got to vote in Taiwan when you lived there. I'm just curious, when you were growing up in Taiwan, what did voting mean to you? Did you think about the first time you'd be able to cast a vote?
Yeah, I remember it being a really big thing. We were told that every vote is sacred and you have to make your voice heard. Something that I find strange here is voting is on a weekday.
Tuesday is such a random day for an election. You moved to the U.S. in 2008, and there was a big and significant election that year. You were a permanent resident from 2012 into 2016, so unable to vote during those years. Tell me about your decision to become a citizen.
Well, I decided I wanted to become a citizen because of the election in 2016. Before that, I was just a permanent resident. I didn't really have a strong urge to become a citizen. I just felt like everything's working, everything's fine. I don't think you all need just one vote from me. But after the election in 2016, I remember distinctly that night I was like, I have to do something. And the first thing I can do was just put in my application for citizenship. And I did that the very next week. And I was determined to make sure that I get my citizenship and vote in all of the elections.
So with the unexpected turn of events in 2016, did you see something at stake for you, Joe, like personally, if you didn't have the right to vote the next time around?
I did see something personal. I am an immigrant, and this administration is not pro-immigrant, whether it's my fellow immigrants, my fellow minorities. It just didn't sit well with me to not participate. So in order to be in the discussion, in order to be in the conversation, I feel like I need to participate.
I mean, I'm guessing there are new arrivals in this country who will probably vote next Tuesday for the first time, and they'll vote a Republican ticket straight down the line. Would that surprise you?
Honestly, at this point, I'm not really surprised at anything anymore. They all say, like, make America great, but immigrants are what makes America great. Like, immigrants and slaves built this country. Everyone has their right to vote for whoever they want, but for me, voting Republican would not be advocating for myself or immigrants such as myself.
So we were trading emails earlier this week setting up this interview, and you wrote, America needs to wake up and learn from the rest of the world, and I hope my vote will help. So will you try to do anything more to wake up Americans other than casting your vote?
Oh, absolutely. Since 2016, I've found this need to advocate for myself and for immigrants and for minorities and for people who are disenfranchised in this country. I guess is my way of doing my part.
Joe, are you voting next Tuesday or did you do early voting?
I did early voting. I actually went the first day of early voting, 7 a.m., showed up at the polls and casted my early vote.
Job done. Jo Huang Zollner, originally from Taiwan, a first-time voter, already done it. Thanks for being with us, Joe. Really good to talk.
Thank you so much, Marco.
So a lot of people are going to the polls on Tuesday with immigration on their minds. Others are thinking about this.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord.
President Trump's announcement came last spring, and with it, a big shift. The federal government ditched efforts to cut carbon emissions. That responsibility then shifted to state and local leaders. That shift might continue after the midterm elections next week. Climate change is on the ballot in the form of a handful of different energy initiatives from Washington State to Florida. The World's Carolyn Beeler is here to give us some global context on those ballot initiatives. Let's start on the West Coast with Washington, which is proposing a tax on carbon emissions. Is that right?
That's right. This is probably the biggest climate-related ballot initiative that we're going to see on Tuesday. If it's passed, it would be the first carbon tax in the U.S., but it wouldn't be the first globally. British Columbia, just across the border from Washington, has a carbon tax. So does the European Union and about two dozen other individual countries. This ballot initiative in Washington is being viewed as an early test of whether a nationwide carbon tax could be politically viable. Here's how Daniel Lassoff from the World Resources Institute is thinking about what happens on Tuesday.
Well, I think if the Washington carbon tax initiative passes despite opponents outspending supporters by 2-1, that will send a message that this is something that can be achieved politically when you have the right coalition.
That message could be pretty significant because carbon taxes are seen as some of the most effective ways to sort of shift markets and cut carbon going forward.
So let's move a little southeast from Washington State. Renewable energy quotas are on the ballot in Nevada and Arizona.
Yes, in both states, there's an initiative on the ballot that would require half of the state's electricity to come from solar or wind by 2030. More than half of U.S. states already have a renewable energy requirement, but if either of these pass, they'd be among the most ambitious in the country. To put this in a global context, remember that big U.N. report that came out a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, get our act together by 2050 and keep 1.5 Celsius the bar.
Exactly. So that would require us to get to net zero emissions by 2050, just to put that 2030 goal in context.
And finally, you've got fracking and offshore drilling. Those are on the ballots in a couple of states.
Yeah, in Colorado, a proposal would dramatically limit fracking. And in Florida, a ballot initiative would ban offshore drilling in state waters.
So we're just about to hear a story on how climate change might impact one congressional race in Texas. But before we get to a specific example, Carolyn, just give us the big picture on how much climate change is playing into the elections.
Sure. So as I'm sure you've noticed, if you've gotten mailings from candidates or have watched their ads on TV, climate change is not the marquee issue of this election.
Not talked about a lot.
No. As a matter of fact, in a recent Pew survey, Americans ranked global warming as the 15th most important issue they're thinking about as they weigh congressional candidates. If you compare that to, say, Germany, climate change regularly ranks near the top of public fears for the future. But in select races, climate change is starting to play something of a role. So there are about two or three dozen races from House to Senate to governor's races where climate change has worked its way into the dialogue. And that seems to have increased since this big UN report came out a couple of weeks ago.
Carolyn Beeler, thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome, Marco.
Let's turn now to that race for the 7th congressional district seat in Texas. The district includes parts of Houston and its suburbs. It's one of the wealthiest in the state, and it's been solidly Republican for half a century. This year, though, the race is a dead heat. One of the issues is the legacy of Hurricane Harvey and growing threats from climate change. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
Hurricane Harvey was the second costliest natural disaster in U.S. history. $125 billion in damage. When the storm hit last year, floodwaters rose to about 3 feet in neighborhoods like Meyerland in southwest Houston.
And it's got about 4,000 homes and 95% flooded, maybe only a few hundred did not.
Art Pronin takes me on a driving tour of the area. He's president of the Meyerland Democrats. This area has flooded multiple times in recent years. Pronin says residents have been repeatedly promised infrastructure improvements, but they feel forgotten.
Still got a mortgage, stuck in a house that is flooded multiple times, can't sell it. And there's just this mounting sense of just, like, agony out here.
Cronin wants the flow of federal dollars sped up to help reduce the impact from future floods. He's also worried about the growing influence of climate change in making big storms even bigger. But the man who represents this area in Congress, 9-time Republican incumbent John Culberson, has long questioned the scientific consensus on climate change.
To this day, even after Harvey, John Culberson will not admit to man-made climate change.
Culberson's Democratic challenger, Lizzie Fletcher, an attorney who has never held political office, forcefully acknowledged the reality of climate change. But that was during the Democratic primary. Today, she still talks about flooding, but you won't find any mention of climate change on her campaign website. I didn't get a chance to ask her about that. Her campaign rejected my interview request, as did John Culberson's. Polls show nationwide, climate change just isn't a big deal for most voters. And in conservative Texas, avoiding talk of climate science altogether, it's not unusual.
I'd say people are a little bit wary of using the term.
Ann Olson runs the Buffalo Bayou Partnership, a nonprofit that oversees a 10-mile stretch of creek that flooded last year. She says Harvey was a wake-up call.
Climate change is something that I just think now people in Houston are realizing is something that is going to affect Houston in the future.
And the topic doesn't have to be taboo.
If you're practical about it and not hysterical and have concrete solutions, then I think people will listen.
Bill White is a former Democratic mayor of Houston. His home also flooded last year, by the way. During White's mayoral tenure, he talked up energy efficiency. And Houston, a city that runs on oil and gas money, invested heavily in renewable power. White adds that voters were more than okay with that.
Not sort of bragging, but, you know, I was reelected by 91% here.
Still, talking about these issues in Texas can get you in trouble, says political scientist Mark Jones at Rice University's Baker Institute.
For Mayor White, he's not Governor White because in 2010, he ran a gubernatorial campaign against Rick Perry, and Perry attacked him on his environmental record, and he lost by 13 points.
This year, Jones says the congressional race in West Houston and the suburbs is really a referendum on President Trump. That's why this deep red district is competitive for the first time in 50 years. So Jones says Lizzie Fletcher's cautious approach toward climate change is wise.
Houston is the energy capital of the world. It's the fossil fuel energy capital of the world. So you're not likely to win a lot of votes really trumpeting climate change. People who truly believe in climate change and believe it's a problem, they're already voting for Lizzie Fletcher.
Jones says Fletcher doesn't want to give Republicans who are leaning toward her any reasons not to vote for her. For environmentalists, they get how the climate game is played in Texas.
It's disappointing, and it's smart politics. The energy corridor goes right through her district, so I understand the complexity of it. I want her to get elected.
Sandy Spears is a preschool teacher in Houston and climate activist with the group 350.org. She's held handmade signs about climate change over the freeway overpass and hosts teach-ins on climate science. A few years ago, her story was unthinkable.
I was born and raised Republican, and then I realized where the money was coming in, and kind of my heroes, became fallen heroes, and I thought they're looking straight into the camera and saying something's not true, and I know that they know the science.
Now Spears is going door-to-door supporting candidates who she thinks get it on climate change, including Lizzie Fletcher. She says she's seeing progress in her work. Before Harvey, many people used to just ignore her.
Now I have people come up and whisper, yeah, I think climate change is true. So at least they're admitting it now.
And in this razor-thin congressional election, polls are calling it a toss-up. It's possible those whisperers could make the difference. For The World, Jason Margolis, Houston.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. I still remember walking into the intimate bookshop in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, where I grew up. The creaky stairs, the smell of old paper and wood, and they were always playing Blue Note Jazz. Sadly, the place is closed now, Every community should have a bookstore like that, and there is one like it in Southampton, England. October Books, it's called. Recently, the shop had to find a new home because of a rent hike. As luck would have it, an old bank down the block came on the market. October Books raised more than $500,000 from the community to buy it. Then came another challenge: how to move thousands of books from the old shop down the street to the new one. The solution they came up with attracted international attention. People from the neighborhood showed up to move the inventory by hand. They formed a human chain and passed the books one at a time, hand to hand, down the main street. I called up Claire Diaper, the director at October Books, to hear about it. Hello, it's Marco Werman here. Good to meet you.
And you.
Well, is it busy there right now, Claire? What's going on around you?
So at the moment, I'm in the old shop, and it's quite quiet because all the volunteers that we have here this afternoon are up at our new premises helping to put books out on the shelves.
Tell me about the new location. What's it like?
Oh, it just looks amazing. We put the first books on the shelves last night. We've got the old safe is our storeroom, which is where we move the books into from the human chain at the weekend.
I got to say, the move itself sounds like, you know, when I used to move, when I was actually able to pick up a lot of boxes, you know, just get a bunch of people together and, you know, you have some pizza and you move together. And later on, somebody else needs to move and you help them.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. That sort of rolling crowd of people who all help each other. The human chain was really about not about moving large volumes of books, but getting everybody involved and having an event that everybody could participate in.
So, like, who turned out? Who were some of the volunteers? And did they tell you why they came out to help?
A lot of them are people who've been customers in the bookshop, because we've been in Southampton for 40 years. And, sorry, I'm just going to hang on a moment.
Okay. I know it's the middle of your workday.
Yep. We've still got customers coming into the old shop.
You take care of business.
We're actually closed, but there's somebody who wanted to come
in. I love
in,
small so. Town retail, you know, we're closed, but come on in, I know you, yeah. So did any of the volunteers tell you why they came out to help?
I know there was a young child with their mum, and the mum just sort of said, my daughter's been looking forward to this for weeks. Every day she's been asking me, is today the day?
Oh, wow.
Is today the day? I don't know, she just understood, I guess, that it was something, you know, being part of the community. And I think for the majority of people, that was why they came.
You've been attracting quite a lot of media attention because of the human chain. How has that been?
We are just overwhelmed with the response. And I'm going to get emotional now. A friend came in today and she said, it feels like you've given the world a big hug.
Mm.
And I just love that thought, that this small, simple act here in Southampton has just given people all around the world some hope.
Claire Diaper, the director of October Books in Southampton, thank you very much.
Thank you. That's great.
Saving a bookshop. Then there's saving books. That's Julie Strauss-Gabel's job, sort of. She's in charge of the Penguin Books division, Dutton. As you may know, the publishing industry has a lot to contend with, like competition from e-books and a whole generation of kids who grew up reading on screens. Enter the Dwar Sligger.
It felt just like such a eureka moment when I saw it. I knew it was something that people would respond to.
Dwar Sligger is a whole new format for books, produced by only one company there in the Netherlands. This month, Dutton is starting to release the books in the United States with a box set of novels by the best-selling young adult author John Green. The publisher, Julie Strauss-Gabel, told me about the first time she saw a Dwar Sligger.
So when we license books around the world in other languages, we always get copies contractually. And in this case, John's Dutch publisher had sublicensed the book to be in the Dwar Sligger format.
And John is John Green, the author of
young adult
novels. Yeah.
And I saw them and I knew they would be just tremendous to have in the United States, but did not know that we didn't even have them.
Why did you think they would catch on in the U.S.?
They're so ingenious. I don't know if you've had the chance to actually hold one.
I haven't held one, but I've seen them in action. So maybe describe it for us.
So it is a horizontal reading experience. So you read top to bottom. So the page is not unlike the page of any paperback, really. They are hinged instead of a normal spine. So they basically lay flat and you can truly hold them in one hand and hold a subway pole with the other or walk or do anything.
So interestingly, these books are about the size of a smartphone, and
yes,
the way you turn pages almost sounds like you're scrolling through the text. Was that intentional? Were you thinking about a younger audience?
It was not intentional in that the thought was, this is the thing we've been looking for to counterbalance electronic reading. I think it was all of the things that we've come to know, especially about younger readers or our audience, but I think about a lot of book lovers, is that most of them prefer print, but they read a lot, and so they carry books around. And so it made complete sense in that you can truly stick it in the pocket the same way you could with your phone, but you're giving people the thing they really love about books, which is a book.
The Dutch call this format Dwarsligger. I'm guessing it's probably pronounced Dwarsligger.
Yes.
What does that mean?
You've got closer than me. Actually, it is, like many good brand names, it means a few things at once. So literally, it can mean like tracks, or I don't know if it's train tracks, but it can sort of refer to something, the like horizontal plane of it. Uh-huh. But it is also a word that may be more slang that refers to somebody who thinks differently.
So, Julie, how far do you see Dwarsligger going for Penguin Dutton? Is it not going to be just for young adults, but also adults at some point? Well, do you hope it reignites a hunger for reading?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, anything that we can do, and we just want more and more people reading books in any form, so especially to reinvigorate, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, I feel very strongly about print because so much of what I read is online, and actually the act of reading a paper novel, just finished The Magpie Murders by Anthony Horowitz, which actually involves two different typefaces, and it was just relaxing. It grounded me, and it's kind of given me a reappreciation of reading a novel in print. So I look forward to what you come up with next.
Thank you.
Julie Strauss-Gabel, the head of the Penguin imprint for young readers, Dutton Books. I'm Marco Werman. New U.S. economic sanctions on Iran are about to kick in, and they're likely to hit the Islamic Republic hard.
These new sanctions couldn't come at a worse time for Iran. And the question is, you know, how long will Iran be able to withstand this?
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. More sanctions are coming. That's the message from the Trump administration to Iran. Those new sanctions kick in next Monday. Today, top officials at the White House explained how they will work. Some countries like India and China will be granted temporary waivers. That means they can continue to buy Iranian oil for a while. U.S. sanctions will remain in force until Iran meets Washington's demands, like ending support for terrorism, ending Iran's military engagement in Syria, and halting its nuclear and ballistic missile development. Karim Sajapour is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Karim, so now we know what's in and what's out for this round of sanctions. What is the verdict? Are they as harsh as you expected?
These sanctions are pretty harsh. Essentially, the United States is forcing companies and countries around the world to make a very simple choice, and that is, do you want to do business with America or do you want to do business with Iran? Because you can't do both. And for most countries and companies around the world, that's a pretty simple choice. They may be, you know, slightly exposed to the Iranian market, but you know, top-tier companies around the world have major exposure to the United States, and they will probably calculate that the risk of doing business in Iran is simply too high. So European politicians aren't happy about this, but if you talk to European CEOs, they say, well, we may not agree with this verdict from the United States, but it's just too risky for us to continue doing business with Iran.
The Trump administration says these measures are intended to force the Iranian government to change its ways. So how badly will government revenues in Iran actually be hit?
Well, the lifeblood of Iran's economy is its oil and gas revenue, and these sanctions are going to hit hard Iran's ability to produce and to export oil. So it is definitely going to be hit hard, and this is happening at a time when Iran is having, you know, it's experiencing a currency crisis, it's experiencing labor protests, you know, a lot of Iranian laborers who haven't been paid for months. There's social crises in Iran, women taking to the streets, removing their mandatory headscarves. And Iran is experiencing, you know, great geopolitical tumult. It's spending billions of dollars overseas to fund its allies, whether that's the Assad regime in Syria or Shiite militias throughout the region. So these new sanctions couldn't come at a worse time for Iran. And the question is, you know, how long will Iran be able to withstand this? It appears their current strategy is just to try to wait out the Trump administration. The Iranian calculation is that this is only going to be temporary until this administration is voted out of office. And of course, there's no guarantees of that happening.
Karim, I also think of ordinary Iranians who need stuff like food and medicine. How do you think the sanctions will impact them?
Well, in theory, there should be exemptions for medicine, you know, humanitarian items, pharmaceuticals. But in practice, what ends up happening is that because few banks want to process transactions with Iran, there are shortages of these types of, you know, incredibly important items. And so there's been press reports of shortages and, you know, chemotherapy medicine, life-saving drugs. And so, you know, it is absolutely the case that I kind of liken sanctions to chemotherapy, and that, you know, you not only target the tumor, but you kill a lot of healthy cells as well when you do chemotherapy. And, you know, these sanctions against Iran are very onerous, and they are absolutely going to hurt ordinary Iranians. And, you know, the question is, how do people react? Whom do they blame? My sense is that sanctions oftentimes accentuate people's existing political disposition.
Karim Sajapour at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington. Always good to have you with us. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
One of Washington's main allies against Iran is Saudi Arabia. That relationship has come under new scrutiny because of what happened to the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It's been 1 month since he walked into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then disappeared. Details about the case have been slow to come out. Turkish officials have said they have evidence that he was murdered by Saudi agents. Today, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan went so far as to say, quote, "The order to kill Khashoggi came from the highest levels of the Saudi government." That statement came in an op-ed in the Washington Post. The World's Shirin Jafari has this update on where things stand in the case.
The first time Khatija Cengiz met Jamal Khashoggi, she was starstruck. In a nerdy way.
I had been following Jamal's writings and social media activities for 3-4 years. When I saw him, I went straight to him to introduce myself. We started talking. I felt very happy, very positive about our conversation.
Cengiz, speaking here with the BBC, is a PhD student focusing on the Middle East. Before they knew it, the two were in love and planning a wedding. But that's where Cengiz and Khashoggi's love story ends. To get married, Khashoggi needed some documents. Documents he could only get at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. So he made an appointment. He walked in the door, never walked out.
The Saudi government insists to conduct their own independent investigation.
Sharif Mansour is the Middle East and North Africa program coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
The Turkish government insists that they interview and conduct interrogations with suspects in Turkey.
Saudi Arabia has rounded up 18 suspects who it says carried out the killing. Turkish officials want to question them, but the Saudis aren't handing them over. Instead, in a show of cooperation, Riyadh sent the Saudi public prosecutor to Turkey earlier this week. He was there to take part in a joint investigation with Turkey. 3 days later, Turkish officials announced there was no concrete results to speak of. The Saudi prosecutor left.
And to this day, we don't know where the body is, where Khashoggi's remains are, and the Turkish officials would not release the hard evidence they claim to have of video and audio showing the exact moments in which he was killed.
No body, no video, no audio. That's where the investigation stands today, at least officially. Turkish officials have offered a few details. That Khashoggi was dead within minutes of entering the consulate, that he was strangled, that his body was dismembered and destroyed. The Saudis' explanation has changed several times. First, they said Khashoggi walked out of the consulate. Then they said he died in a fistfight. And now the line is that his death was premeditated. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been mostly tight-lipped about Khashoggi's death. But at a conference in Riyadh last week, he described it as, quote, a heinous crime that cannot be justified. While all this has been going on, Citizen Lab, an organization that researches technology, global security, and human rights, has been doing its own kind of investigation. They've been tracking the reach of Saudi surveillance, and they discovered that another Saudi activist based in Quebec was being monitored by the kingdom. Just like Khashoggi, Omar Abdul Aziz is an outspoken critic of the Saudi government. And Ron Diebert, who heads the Citizen Lab, says Abdul Aziz's iPhone had been compromised.
All we could see was there's an infected device in Quebec checking into this infrastructure operated by Saudi Arabia. So what we did is really a process of deduction and kind of old school investigative techniques.
Abdul Aziz told Diebert he was worried because he'd been in touch with Khashoggi.
And he said to me that Jamal and he had been planning for many, many months activities around social media activism. And he was very afraid that the surveillance on his device could have contributed to Khashoggi's disappearance.
We don't know if it did, but Diebert says Khashoggi's death and the surveillance of Abdul Aziz's iPhone shows the extent of the Saudi government's reach.
This is a regime that, as we know, is not afraid to reach across borders and literally get inside the pockets and the purses of those they consider to be a threat.
Today, in an op-ed in The Guardian and The Washington Post, Khashoggi's fiancé calls on the international community to bring the perpetrators to justice. Of all the nations, Khatija Cengiz writes, the United States should be leading the way. Sharif Mansour says human rights groups have been urging the United Nations to do its own independent investigation.
What we want is that this becomes the story of how Khashoggi's death led the international community to act, not the story of him paying the ultimate price, taking those threats on behalf of himself, on behalf of other journalists in vain.
This is an extraordinary case, he says. The response to it should be extraordinary, too. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
There's a large show of U.S. military force heading to the border with Mexico. President Trump says those troops are needed to prevent thousands of Central American migrants from entering the United States. In a speech yesterday, the president said he's planning to issue an executive order that would make big changes in border security. That includes the way migrants entering the U.S. will be allowed to apply for asylum. The Mexican government has also invited the migrants to apply for asylum in Mexico. Officials there say more than 2,000 migrants are taking up that offer. Emily Green is a reporter based in Mexico City. She's been following the story of the migrant caravans. I'd like to begin our chat just listening to a comment from Gretchen Kuhner. She's the director of the Institute for Women in Migration in Mexico City. You spoke with her about people in the caravan seeking asylum in Mexico.
The strategy of the federal government is allowing people to apply for asylum from detention within either Chiapas or Oaxaca. But for those people who are continued to, you know, move along, the strategy is to try to wear them out. The federal government is trying to, you know, make it as difficult as possible so that people will give up.
That's Gretchen Kuhner, the director of the Institute for Women in Migration in Mexico City. So, Emily, when she says federal government, of course, she's talking about Mexico's federal government. When you spoke with her, did she give you the sense that people from Honduras and Guatemala are giving up their route to the U.S.-Mexico border and staying in Mexico?
I do think that people are dropping off. The caravan has gotten smaller. What the Mexican government said yesterday was that 3,000 people have applied for asylum. They also said that about 1,000 people have withdrawn those asylum requests and asked to go back to their home country.
Let's unpack the part of Gretchen's comment a moment ago where she said the federal government of Mexico is trying to make it as difficult as possible so that people will give up. I mean, there's this video of Mexican authorities flying over several hundred migrants in a helicopter. What are they actually doing?
Another caravan that had come from Honduras, they were crossing the Suchiate River, which is this sort of narrow river between Guatemala and Mexico. And essentially, the Mexican government is trying to stop them, and they were flying this helicopter very close above them in a dangerous way that would have made anybody crossing that river at risk of drowning. But we have seen this time and again from the Mexican government that they're ultimately letting them enter, but under very harrowing circumstances.
So helicopter flyovers, are there other ways that the Mexican government is trying to deter the migrants from moving on?
Right. There was a big effort to organize buses to take these migrants to Mexico City. And it seemed like that was going to happen. And essentially what I'm hearing is that the federal government threatened the bus companies. It said, you cannot rent these buses. We could charge you with smuggling.
Wow.
And so now, instead of the migrants getting on buses and going to Mexico City, they are going to go, they're going to take a very roundabout route. They're going to go to Veracruz by foot. So I would say the federal government, they're not stopping the caravan, but they are impeding efforts to help the migrants. And I think, back to Gretchen's point, it's with the idea that it's going to tire the migrants out, that they will ask for asylum and then be placed in detention, or that they will decide they're going to return to their home country voluntarily.
So the helicopter you spoke about earlier, that was doing a flyover over another caravan, is that right?
Right. Right now, there are four caravans in progress to the United States. There's the big main one that we've been reporting on extensively. Mm. And as of last night, that was in Juchitán, and that has about 4,000 people. There's a second one that is a couple of days behind that main one, and it has around 1,500 people. There's a third one comprised of mostly Salvadorans, and that has a couple of hundred people. And most of those people have turned themselves into Mexican authorities and are applying for asylum, which also means that they're in detention. And then there's a fourth caravan that is made up of more than 1,000 people, and that's right now on the Guatemalan-Mexican border. So this is really remarkable. Now when we talk about caravan, we should be talking about caravans, plural.
Mm. And all of these people essentially with the same hope to get asylum ultimately in the United States.
Right. I would say the vast majority want to get asylum in the United States. You know, we shouldn't put on rose-colored lenses. I mean, there are people in this group who lived in the United States and were deported. And I think their hope is to get to the U.S. border and then try and cross into the country illegally. But the vast majority do want to apply for asylum.
Reporter Emily Green, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
We asked, you answered. We wanted the thoughts of those of you who immigrated to the U.S. and are going to vote for the very first time next Tuesday. We got some great feedback. You heard some of it earlier, and we've got more. Pudmini Thulipala wrote us to say she was eligible to become an American citizen nearly 30 years ago, but she didn't want to give up citizenship in her home country. Last year, though, that changed. She got her U.S. citizenship. Pudmini writes, I am excited to cast my first ever vote in next week's midterm election. I have never voted anywhere before. Miguel in Miami also answered our call. This is my second vote in America, he wrote. Wait, this is a trick answer. Miguel continues, I got to vote on Sunday for the Brazilian election, and on Tuesday I voted early in the midterm election. Though it's compulsory to vote in Brazil, he writes, I still consider the right to vote as a right that must be exercised. No argument here. And here's what we heard from new voter Marco Rosa in North Carolina. He's very excited about taking part in the midterms.
I voted in Italy when I was living in Italy. I voted as an absentee in some Swiss elections. In Italy, it was all paper ballots and a pencil. The precinct captains actually open up each vote and count it and then send in a result to the centralized area where their votes are counted. I've always been a strong believer that voting is not just a right, but a duty. So to me, it meant really doing my part, whether my candidates or my parties would win or lose. At least I did share the sentiment of like-minded people. I just recently became a United States citizen, literally on Halloween, so 2 days ago. And I swore allegiance to the United States of America, proudly, I must say. And I already had in mind my first order of business was to go and vote here in North Carolina. I really wanted to do my part in this extremely important election. The feeling was great. It was a feeling of satisfaction. There were some names on the ballot of people that I wasn't particularly fond of. And to be able to vote against that candidate was really a feeling of empowerment. I was so happy to say, okay, I did it. You know, I had my sticker. I walked out of there elated. I really like the fact that here, every year there's an election. Every year you have an opportunity to have your say in how your state or federal government works.
Marco Rosa there in Raleigh, North Carolina. If you are also a new U.S. citizen and are voting for the first time here in the U.S., we want to hear from you too. What does voting in the 2018 midterm election mean to you? And how does it compare with voting in another country? Send us an email to myworld@theworld.org. Again, that's myworld@theworld.org. Finally, a little something for fans of Queen. The film Bohemian Rhapsody is out today in the U.S. It's about the life of the late lead singer, Freddie Mercury. But there's little focus in it on the time Mercury spent in East Africa as a boy and young man. He grew up in Zanzibar, just off the coast of Tanzania, which is where the BBC's Victoria Uwanhunda went recently, just to learn about the roots of one of modern pop music's most enduring voices.
Tonight. In 1946, in a stately looking house that's now become a hotel in the middle of Stone Town, a boy was born. He will go on to become one of the world's most influential rock stars. Back then, he was named Farouk Bulsara, but the world knows him as Freddie Mercury. Yakub Abdul Karim, who now manages the hotel Freddie Mercury's house used to be, is very proud of looking after a home that once belonged to one of the world's most recognized names.
Freddie Mercury was living in this house while he was a child, and especially when he was coming from London. He was staying with the parents. Parents were living here. And he was coming always here in holidays. After that, we have taken this building in 2000 as a Tembo House apartment. And we are running almost now for 15 years, this Mercury apartment.
Dividing his time between three countries, England, India, where he went to school, and his birthplace, young Freddie will have walked the narrow streets of Stone Town, hanging out with childhood friends on the fine white sanded beaches just below the house he was born in. But things changed when, aged 17, Freddie and his family had to leave the island following the Zanzibar Revolution in 1964. But more than 50 years later, his star still shines bright, even among the younger generations who wouldn't have been born when he was alive.
Yeah, Freddie Mercury, he was born in Zanzibar. He was a popular musician from the group of Queen. We love his music, but we didn't get to see him because I'm young Zanzibarian and I didn't see him.
Very few people in Zanzibar will have had the chance to see Freddie Mercury and Queen perform. But one man, Zanzibari fashion designer Farouk Abdellah, struck gold.
I saw him perform once, I think it was in Wembley, and he was a showman. I mean, a really flamboyant showman. But the sad thing is, of all during his lifetime, he never once mentioned Zanzibar, that he came from Zanzibar. But then again, I don't think he was ashamed of it. I think he wanted to keep the mystery. So people ask questions, who's he, where's he from? I think it was deliberate. Of course, legacy is his music, which doesn't go very well in Zanzibar because quite a lot of people here, they don't understand, they don't really like rock and roll. But he could have done more with HIV and AIDS. That would have been a lasting legacy for his birthplace, which unfortunately he didn't.
And at a time when there remained a huge stigma around HIV/AIDS, Freddie never spoke about his personal experience until in November 1991, he finally confirmed he had been diagnosed with the disease. In just over 24 hours later, the world will lose one of its greatest ever musical voices. Freddie Mercury had passed away at the age of 45. More than 70 years after his birth, his legacy lives on well beyond a small island, which remains proud to call Freddie Mercury a son. Nothing really matters to me.
Bohemian Rhapsody, ending that story by Victoria Unhunda, arguably Queen's most famous track, and also the title of the film that's out today about the life of Freddie Mercury and his rise to stardom with Queen. That's our show for this Friday. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You have a great weekend. We'll be back with you on Monday. Anyway, the wind blows.
PRI, Public Radio International.